Okay, so now to this lecture, we'll first define a category of abelian von Neumanns of algebras, and then we'll try and define the notion of a state space. Now, as I mentioned briefly at the start of yesterday's lecture, why we use, okay, you still don't know what this is, but this is abelian algebras. So I tried to justify why we use this topos, and now I'll just say a little bit more. So you remember in lecture, well, two, I think, when we talked about the Cauchy-Specker theorem, and that theorem told you that you cannot assign values to all quantities in a consistent way at the same time. But it still allows the possibility to assign values to abelian subsets of your quantities. So with respect to this abelian subset, the Cauchy-Specker theorem doesn't hold, and you have a chance to kind of write your theory in a bit more classical way. And this is precisely why this topos was used. So for now, just consider this as abelian algebras of operators. So if you have this abelian algebras of operators, then your Presheaf is such that it's defined contextually. And for each context, this is as if it was a classical approximation. And for each context, the local definition is kind of classical. You don't have any non-commuting operator, so you don't have the funny business of quantum theory. So that is why this Presheaf was chosen, because it allows you to define each of your quantum objects, which is all of this, in terms of local classical snapshots. And these local classical snapshots are classical in a way. However, the collection of all these guys represents your quantum object, so the collection is what you're considering. And because the collection of all these algebras forms a category, then you can always map informations, which means that you never lose the global picture because you can always map local context to local context. So it's this map here, so it's the categorical structure that contains the quantum information in a way. This is just to repeat what I said, but just you remember. Okay, so now what are these guys? Okay, now I could. What I'm going to do, instead of writing all the definitions of C star algebras and rings, etc., which I did write in the lecture notes, what I will do instead is construct for a particular example abelian von Neumanns of algebras so that you kind of see how they are, how you can derive them. And the definitions are all in the lecture notes, but I think it's a bit more instructive to actually do a concrete example. So first of all, you have your algebras of bounded operators. Then what you do is you consider an abelian subalgebra of this, and you define the commutant, which is basically all the operators in here, which commute with all the operators in your algebra. There's obvious subalgebra of this guy. Then you do it again. So you take the commutant of this guy. And if these two are the same, then this guy is abelian von Neumann algebra generated by this algebra here. Is a very trivial definition. Well, it's not trivial, but is a. Well, you can define it like that. This is more a constructive definition, which is easier to implement when you actually do examples. But you can obviously, in the lecture notes, there'll be the definition in terms of C-star algebras. But for now, we're going to use this in order to actually construct this algebras for particular examples. Okay, so let's give an example. Let's consider a four-dimensional Hilbert space. And you choose a basis. Which have projection operators associated to them, meaning that this guy's project on this one-dimensional subspace is what these projection operators are. Now, a possible way of representing in terms of matrix these operators is, well, it's quite simple. I'll just write it here, actually. 1 0 0 0 Very simple example. Okay, now given this, what is the algebras of bounded operators? So this guy will be all 4x4 matrices with complex entries. Now, what you want to construct the correspondent abelian von Neumanns of algebras. If you did apply that definition, and imagine you get an abelian subalgebra of this guy, which is generated by these four projection operators, then the corresponding von Neumann algebra would be basically all linear, complex linear combinations of these projection operators. So 4x4 matrices complex entry in the diagonal. And this, because of the Hilbert space, four dimension, these are the projection operators associated to this space. This is actually one of the biggest abelian algebras that you can define, von Neumann. So it's called the maximum abelian von Neumann algebra. Obviously, if you chose a different basis, which is not related by a phase factor, so it's a different base, then you would end up with different projection operators associated to them. And you would end up with another maximum abelian von Neumanns of algebra. In fact, there are uncountably many of them. Okay, now, but what if? Well, actually, that's first. Okay, so these are maximum. What are the also non-maximal ones? And in this example, what are the non-maximal ones? They are the following. You have this guy here, which basically now you consider only these two operators to be free. And you group these two. So now this guy is all matrices, which are still complex entry in the diagonal, but now this two are so they're all linear combination of these three projection operators. So you will never get one that has only a complex entry here and one that's only a complex entry here. And this is clearly subalgebra of that. Then you can also go further down and you can define this guy. Now you leave only one free and you group all the rest. And this is again a subalgebra, both of this and of this. Now, if this guy, for example, were the same, there's one actually. This guy was the same. Then you could have the situation in which these two maximum abelian subalgebra have an intersection, and in particular have the V intersection to V prime, would be V1, 2, and V1, and V2. Okay, here by this notation, I mean when I put the index here, it means that you leave free the operator's index. And here you leave free these two operators. So why is that? So V1, 2 is equal to that, right? Now this guy is the complement of this two. So it's 1 minus which is equal tautology here. Hang on a second. So is equal to P3 plus 4, okay, which is also equal Q3 plus Q4. Right. So this guy is always the complement of this two. And the same for V1. So V1 would be the same if you consider as a subalgebra of this guy or that guy. Is that clear? Okay, so, I mean, there are lots of many different von Neumann abelian von Neumann subalgebra, but you can already start seeing this categorical structure. Since if you have two algebras, then you can define a map between them if there is an inclusion. For example, this guy, or this guy here, etc., etc. So for that, for the ones that I wrote, you end up with something like this. It's going to be a little messy, but I'll try. So you get something like that. So the arrows is inclusion. Wow. So anyway, it gets a little messy, but, and this is only two. I mean, imagine you get loads and so on, right? So you get all, et cetera, et cetera. So, from this example, you can now define the category of abelian von Neumann subalgebras. there's this guy here, such that objects are these algebras, and morphisms are inclusions. Now, the physical meaning of this inclusion is a kind of information type meaning, in the sense that when you go to a smaller algebra, you lose information. Since in the big algebra, you're going to have many more operators, in particular many more self-adjoint operators, so you have more information than when going to a smaller algebra. So this map is a kind of increase of information, or decrease if you go the other way around. And there's a concept called coarse graining. So when you lose information, you coarse grain. So when we will define our sheaves, since the maps, here you fine grain, so you refine information. But when you'll go to the sheaves, although here you refine your information, when you go that way, you're going to lose information. And this, when we'll define proposition, this concept of coarse graining will be quite important. But keep in mind that when you gain information here, you will lose information there. Okay, so this is more an example explanation of sister algebras, because admittedly, there will be some things that you need to know, but you don't need to be an expert in sister algebras to actually do this type of stuff. So it's better to know how to actually build them. Okay, so now let's try and see, given the sister algebra, how it is possible to define, how is possible to define the concept of a state space? Okay, as I said already many times, when trying to define the topos version of quantum theory, the aim was to try and solve certain interpretational problems in the theory, in quantum theory. Certain interpretational problems which derived mainly from the mathematical formalism, because we've seen that a mathematical formalism, or the construction of it, will imply a certain interpretation of the theory. So, for example, in classical theory, the mathematical formalism implies that the theory is realist. Not so for quantum theory. In particular, we have the Cauchy-Specker theorem. So now the question is, okay, we figured out that a possible way of defining more realist theories through this pre-sheaf topos, because it allows a local classical definition of your object. So that is good. But now how to define this object? And you try and get the lesson from classical theory. So in classical theory, the objects are defined such that they give a realist interpretation. So you try and mimic the way in which these objects are defined in classical physics in quantum theory in that topos. So that is the strategy, to then make this object have a more realist interpretation. And one of the objects is a state space. So you want to define a state space in that pre-sheaf, but in such a way that it mimics the way in which the state space is defined in classical theory. So classical state space, as this is kind of easy, right? So you have your states. There's a collection of possible states of your system. That's all it is. I mean, the bare properties. We're not talking about any topology or anything. Just the collection of all states. And this definition of your state space implies that your physical quantities are maps from your state space to the reals. So the, each physical quantity through this map tells you the value of that quantity at a given state. Moreover, this definition allows you for the famous Funk condition, that the value of your physical quantity is equal to the value of a function of a quantity is equal to the function of the value of a quantity. So these are the two main things. Physical quantities are maps from the state space to the reals. And you have this func condition. So we want to define possibly a state space in that topos precisely such that this condition holds. Sorry, physical quantities are this, and two, you have the func condition. So if we define an object in that topos which satisfies this condition, we've done a good job in defining a state space kind of in a classical way. I mean, obviously it's not really going to be classical, but it's, at least it's going to be as close as it gets. So how do you do this? You define your state space. First, I'm going to write the definition, then I'll explain it. So the quantum top of state space is the spectral pre-shift. We kind of encountered it, We kind of encountered, I don't remember when, that when I used an example in terms of this category here, but it's very similar, it's just that now the base category is different. Now we've got von Neumann algebras. So what is a spectral presheaf? So it's a presheaf, so it's a map from your algebra, category of algebras, so it's a contrarian functor, to sets such that for each algebra it will associate its Gelfand spectrum. I'll explain in a second. What this is basically the collection of all multiplicative linear functionals from the algebra to the complex numbers, which give value 1 to the identity operator. It's a map from the algebra to the complex numbers. You can see that it takes an operator, and it will actually give the spectrum of that operator. Now, the fact that it's multiplicative means the following. So up here, for each of your algebra, you get the spectrum of that algebra. You can just think of all simultaneous eigenvalues, really, in a way. Now, this guy here actually has a topology. It's Hausdorff, it's got some properties, it doesn't matter, it's a topology. And each one of this can be interpreted as a classical state space. And you get one for each algebra. I mean, conceptually, you see a state space just gives you certain states, and this will give you all values of the operators in here. What are the maps? So if you have inclusion here, then you get a corresponding presheaf morphism, which now goes the other way. So it goes from the spectrum of the bigger algebra to the spectrum of the small algebra. How is it defined? You get an element of this guy, and you're basically restricted to act only on the subalgebra. So you see, now you're losing information. You lose all those values of operators that are in here, but not in here. So this guy. Then V prime. Okay, now this is the abstract definition of a state space. And I'm claiming that this allows you to actually satisfy these two requirements. So how do you do that? I'm going to delete this guy and keep the picture. All right, we consider locally. So I said locally, this is can be seen as a classical state space. Moreover, so okay, this is, and it's called a Gelfand spectrum. Now this Gelfand spectrum has particular action on operators, particular self-adjoint operators, in the following way. So given an element in the spectrum, then for all self-adjoint operators, so this SA just means self-adjoint operators that are contained in this algebra, this guy will give you the spectrum of A. The reverse, given an element in the spectrum of A, there exists an element in the spectrum of your algebra such that A is equal to the kind of one-to-one correspondence. Moreover, if you have a map, then you can show that the effect of this map on this spectrum of A is equal to the spectrum of the transformed. And this is precisely Funk. So locally, which is kind of expected, right? Locally, for each of these classical state spaces, you actually can satisfy Funk condition. Again, this is kind of circular in the sense of, I mean, this is abelian, so obviously you can respect Funk condition. But, I mean, here we showed it. It's not the case that you can respect it globally, but locally, in terms of this classical snapshots, then Funk condition is respected. So that's good. What about defining physical quantities in terms of maps? Now, in order to do that, we need to use something that is called the Gelfand transform. Is it called the Gelfand? Sorry, Gelfand representation. So what this tells you is that an abelian von Neumann algebra is, roughly speaking, isomorphic to the algebra of the collection of all maps from the spectrum to the complex numbers. So what this means is that for each operator, there exists something that's called the Gelfand transform of that operator, which is a map from the spectrum to the complex numbers. How this Gelfand, so this is called Gelfand transform. I don't know where you put the apostrophe. There's somewhere the apostrophe. Apostrophe? How do you say?
Apostrophe.
Comma? This guy. Apostrophe. So there's a Gelfand transform. how this Galfoyne transform works is as following. It gets an element of the spectrum and it gives you a complex number. How does it give you the complex number? Well, it basically makes that element act on the respective operator. Now, if A is self-adjoint, then A is a physical quantity and B, the spectrum, is in the reals. So the Galfoyne spectrum now would actually be something like that. And this is precisely what we're looking for, at least locally. So we're looking for, and this obviously there's a one-to-one correspondence, this and A hat. So we're looking the possibility of defining physical quantity as maps from the state space to the reals. Locally, you can do it through this Galfoyne representation of Galfoyne transform. Now, it turns out that for this case, you can actually translate this globally. I'm just going to say roughly how to do it, but we still don't know what the reals are in a tuple, so we can't really explain it, but what you do is that locally is fine, yeah? So you have this. Then you have to map this local definition to another context if there is a map between them. Now here you increase your information, but going that way you decrease it. So it could be that A doesn't belong to that. So how exactly do you map this here? As we'll see, I'm not quite sure what lecture, there's a mathematical prescription how to generalize this operator such that it does belong to this guy. It's called the process of dozenization. I don't know if anyone's German here. You're German? Oh, dozenization? To bring into being. Anyway, I don't know. That's what it means in German, right? Or is it a made-up word? It's kind of made up.
It's made up.
Oh, okay. But would you understand it if someone just put it in a sentence? Anyway, so that way of generalizing, you kind of generalize it from above. So you pick the biggest one that is contained here and then it's implied by this. But we'll do that later. Anyway, you generalize it and then up here, so let's call this tilde. And up here you pick this guy, and so on and so forth, so that then, and then you can map all your information to the pre-sheaf structure, so that eventually you actually end up with a global definition of your physical quantities as mapped from the spectral pre-sheaf to something which has the role of the real numbers. It's not quite the real numbers, but it has the role of it. So that property of this, of the classical state space, you can actually define globally. This one just locally. Okay, let's give an example now of the state space. So we get the same four-dimensional Hilbert space, which had those algebras. They had the maximum one. What's this right here? And et cetera, et cetera. Right? Well, I should just write them down. So now we want to define, where did I put it? The spectral pre-sheaf for this algebra. So for each of the algebras, you try and see what is the spectrum of that algebra. So let's try first for the maximal one. So what is the spectral of this algebra? Now this linear complex combination of these four projection operators are all 4x4 matrices with complex entries in the diagonal. So the only real maps which assign values are going to be four, really. The one which gives value 1 to this guy and 0 to all the rest. This one gives value 1 to this and 0 to all the rest. And so on and so forth. What about the smaller one? So here you have only three free projection operators. So you will only really have three maps. These two are the same. So you will definitely have these two guys. And then you have another one that will give value 1 to this and 0 to all the rest, which for now I'm just going to call it like this. And then you have, which one do I write? One. This has got only two. It's got P1, so it has lambda 1. And then I'm going to call lambda 2 prime. Okay, now we need to define maps between them. I wanted to keep, I'm going to go, I have to go here. So if there's a map like this, then there's a map that goes the other way around. So the first we check V1, 2, and V. There's a map going from there to there, since it's subalgebra. So the Presheaf map goes the other way around. From the bigger one to the smaller one. So this has got lambda 1. And the other one has lambda 1 as well, so this is easy. It's got lambda 2. Now what about lambda 3? So lambda 3 gives value 1 to this guy and 0 to all the rest. Now this guy is not in here. However, you have this guy here. And the relation between the two is as follows. And this is a projection operator. This guy can only have value 1 or 0. So if this gets given value 1 and this is bigger, it has to get given value 1, right? So this lambda 3 gets mapped to the only one that gives value 1 to those two. And the same reasoning for lambda 4. What about, well, I'm going to do it like this. How about this? So lambda 1 gets mapped to itself. Now again, the same reasoning applies. This guy gets mapped to the only one that gives 1 to this projection operator, which is implied by lambda by P2. This lambda 2 prime. And in fact, all of them go here. So up here, I lost the eraser. So you get this up here. This is V, this is 1, 2, this is 1. this is tiny. Actually, I'll do it for you again. It's ridiculously small. Okay. There you go. One, one. This is how your spectral sheet works. Actually finished in token. Is it clear now? I mean, it might be a bit abstract to define the spectral of the state space, but if you see it context-wise, you really see that, that it can be seen as a classical state space. Okay, I'm actually finished, but I'll keep on going. Can I do it here? Okay, this is not in the lecture notes because I didn't think it would take that little. So, that's the state space. Another construct, which as defined in classical physics, makes classical physics realist, is the concept of a proposition. Okay, so proposition. Now in classical physics, a proposition, well, normally in physics, when you talk about propositions, you talk about this kind of proposition. So a physical quantity has a given value in some interval. Proposition. And normally this is identified with all those states in your state space such that the value of A for that state is actually in here. So it's basically identified with a subset of your state space for which this proposition is true. Now these propositions in quantum theory identified, in standard quantum theory, identified with projection operators, which project on those states of a Hilbert space for which the value of this projection operator lies, or has a certain value, lies in this interval. So, now what we want to do is to define, in the context of topos theory, a concept of a proposition which is a subset of your state space, subproshi. So we want to somehow identify this proposition with something which is a subset of your state space, or subproshi. I think we did subproshi yesterday. So how do you do this? Okay, now, first of all, you consider this proposition, projection operator, and again, you have to define all your quantities locally in terms of your algebras. So I'm just going to draw it a little bit better. Okay, so you have this proposition. And you see, and it's a projection operator. And you see, you look here and you see if this guy belongs to it. Let's say it does. So what you do is you go up here. And here's the spectrum of this algebra. You pick out all those elements of your spectrum which give value 1. It's not going to fit. To this projection operator. This is a subset of the spectrum. Now you go here and you check if this guy is in here or not. Let's say it's not. So what you do, and here's where this concept of dozenization comes in. What you do is the following. You construct a projection operator. Follows. So when I write this, I mean projection operators in V, which is implied by the original one. Sorry, it's the smallest one that is implied by the original one.
In terms of projection operators, what do you
mean by implied? That it projects on so this projects on a smaller subspace of the Hilbert space in this guy. Which is, yes, which is bigger, yes, precisely. You kind of approximate it by above in a way. So once you do that, then you go here, and now you pick out a subset here. Which is subset, and now gives value 1 to this general projection operator. So it should be a V, yeah? SV dependent. Sorry. And you do that for all of them. So in this way, you can always define a proposition in whatever context you're at. Now, it could be the case that in some context, I mean, maybe this thing is so small that the only projection operator in here which is actually bigger than the original one is the identity. It could be the case. Yeah. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that you can approximate for each context your original projection operator. And then once you do that, you go up here and you get the spectrum of that approximated projection operator. Now, precisely because you can do this approximation for each context, it turns out that for each projection operator, you end up with a pre-sheaf. Such that for each context, it gives you. Okay, it's in two steps. So let's. So for each context, the first thing, it approximates your projection operator, and then it gives you the subset of the spectrum which gives value 1 to this approximated projection operator. So when I don't put the line, it's actually set. That's what I do. So, okay, sorry. So, normally when I put a line, I mean as a pre-sheaf. So, this is a set, but this is, well, there's a set that you can also define this, really. Okay, so you go to each context, you approximate the best you can your projection operator, go up here and get the spectrum of that projection operator. How do you define the maps? Well, the maps are just the induced maps from your state space. And how do you see this now? So let's say you have 3, 5, right? So you first approximate with respect to, so here you want the map going the other way around, right? So you first approximate with respect to this guy. And then you approximate with respect to this guy here. Now, by the process of approximation, if you actually do it, if you do this, for example, so this is a projection operator, and you do this, you approximate it. Because of that definition, this is going to be bigger than the one you approximated in the bigger context. So now, because you have maps that go that way, so this way, you know that if this lambda gives value 1 to this guy is bigger, is going to value 1 to this guy. It makes sense to define the maps this way. So it is true that this pre-sheaf, so to each original quantum proposition, now you translate that as a pre-sheaf, as a sub-object of your state space, in exactly the same way as you define propositions in classical physics. And you do this by this dozenization process, this approximation. The funniest thing is the unity. What do you mean by
I don't have any strictly unit propositions because of
No, actually, no. Well, it becomes trivial. At some point, it will become a proposition will become trivial. But that doesn't matter because your real proposition is all of them. So, at some context, yes, it will just become a trivial just identity. And then, because of the definition of the spectrum, which I lost, you know that. Then it becomes trivial, huh? But that's the only, yeah, funny thing. No, there's nothing funny. No, you never get complications. I mean, obviously, then eventually this, you start off with the, okay, yeah, that's the coarse graining, right? So you start off with a proposition, which means something. A belongs to this. You coarse grain it, right? You're going this way. Remember, here you fine grain, here you're losing information. In fact, you're generalizing your proposition. So that once you coarse grain it, this proposition might mean something like this. More general. You coarse grain as you get to unity, that means that you have a proposition. I mean, it's the most general. Well, not. It means that A has some value. So you keep coarse graining it. And this coarse graining trick will actually be why eventually you can define truth values to all propositions. Because you can always find the very general one to which you can assign truth values. It's a kind of trick. The very general one meaning A has a value. Anyway, now, I don't have time, but next time I'll actually, what's always the sieve to the full, we'll actually give a precise example of how do you define propositions. But that's the general idea. You pick a proposition, you approximate it for each context, and then you get the spectrum of that approximated proposition. And the more you coarse grain it, the less information you have, but the more likely it is for it to be true. In fact, I mean, eventually the truth value will be given in terms of how much you coarse grain it in order to be true. That's actually the physical meaning of sieves in here. It's how much, you can remember sieves are maps. So these maps will eventually represent coarse graining. So it will represent generalizations. And how much you have to generalize it for it to be true will tell you how far away your original one was with the truth. I'm going a bit ahead, getting excited. Next time we'll give an example.